my name.
Okay, your name.
My name is George Ferguson, and I come from...
Where were you born?
In Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. Sydney, Cape Breton. And my father and four brothers and two sisters born in Cape Breton. My mother is from Manganese, and one sister was born in Halifax. And I believe after the father came back from First World War, and he was in father was in the 185th Battalion, and I couldn't tell you what regiment was in, but it was a Scotch regiment, and my father and mother, they spoke Gaelic, which I couldn't speak a word right now of it, maybe one or two words. And but my father always used to tell me, when they were crossing a little bridge somewhere in the country in Sydney, he used to always say to me, "I wish I would have thrown you in the river." And I'd say, "Well, why didn't you?" So my mother said, "Oh, Huey, don't be so foolish." So we moved up to Halifax in the time of the explosion, 1917, and of course I was about 4 or 5 years old. I wouldn't remember what was going on, except what my brother and mother was telling me about these two ships in the harbor, and one collided, and one was full of TNT, and it blew one of the anchors off the ship right across the city to the northwest arm, and I believe it could be still there, but they claim it. Halifax was in was pretty near blown to pieces, except for they have got the ship outside before there was any more damage. And so we were wasn't a not rich family. We tried to go to school, and my father was pensioner, and there was 5 boys and 3 sisters in the family. That's the 10 altogether, counting mother and father. And so we, then when the 30s came along, things started to get a little rough. And I was only 15 or 16. My other brothers were, one or two of them were out of school already. And I had to quit school to go out and work. So to help my family. And I was about 17, and they put on a work program on an airport, digging some hills away for the Larson airfields. And at that time, we used to only get 35 cents an hour. And we were pushing wheelbarrows, and sometimes loading up little dump carts with just single horse and a single dump cart, and we used to load it up, and we used to work from 8 in the morning to 6 at night for 35 cents an hour.
And I guess you were happy to have the job.
Oh yeah, it helped the family, and then we went by, and then I was knew a friend of mine that went to school. He used to go work at F.W. Woolworth's in Halifax on Barron Street, the main street in Halifax. And I used to go down there Friday and Saturday and help them in the storeroom unpacking boxes and things like that. And of course, we used to, the boss would turn around and say, "Well, we hope to see you back here next Friday and Saturday." So he gave us an envelope, and he about $10-$14 in it, and then he would give us some probably half a bucket of candy or something like that to take home. for the rest of the kids and to give them to the kids next door now. And we thought that was pretty good for every week. But then, as I was going down every Friday and Saturday, the weekend, and then he said, maybe one of these days we'll have you down here doing a full night, come down the night time and unpack boxes now. So, well then, my neighbors, the boys I used to come around with, and when we unpacked the boxes, the big crates, well, you could get three or four good-sized fellows in the crate. They were that big. And we used to break the crates up and bundle them up and sell the wood to people that we knew that wanted firewood, and that, so we could go to the show on Saturdays. Now. So then it wouldn't save us from going home and us and our parents for a dime, or then days were like a gold mine, asking for a dime. But I guess today the kids want a dollar before they go on. And so then we worked in the Woolworths there for a while, up until 1938. And so I went into, going ahead of myself, I went into the militia, the artillery, in 1936.
Where did you join?
In Halifax, okay. Number 6 Depot. I was in the Halifax Coast Brigade artillery. And we were on the guns on Sandwich Battery and Fort McNaught, and they had 9.2s and 6-inch and 12-pounders on top of the 9.2. And we used to go down there every summer for 2 weeks training. You know? So then we used to always say, at that time, wished we were in the permanent army so we would get more money, because it seems good and it would help our family to send money home. So time dragged on and we just went along and working when we could get it. So then, in the early 1939, when we got the paper and seen that Germany was taking over Poland and different places, so we were talking about, well, maybe we'll be in the permanent army yet. So one day we were home and we got a notice to be up at the armies for a special meeting. And so that night we went up to Halifax Armories, and had a lecture, and they didn't know when, but they knew, they said that it would pretty soon that we'd be called out, and he said to be ready. So everybody thought that, well, maybe we have to go overseas. So we went home, and the next night we went up to our regular drill, and so we went home. The next day they called us all in, and so we had to pack and our clothes, and the mother asked where we're going. So we said, well, we're taking over Sandwich Battery, and Canada, Britain has declared war against Germany, so Canada had to go along with it. So we went to go rent the batteries and prepare for anything that might come up. And so, well, we were able to go home on every second weekend for a weekend leave.
Were you in the permanent service then?
Not at that time.
Not yet.
No. And then when Canada declared war against Germany in September, then we were signed in for a permit. And we all had to go to another medical, and medical and eyes tests and everything. And so I lost some of the buddies because they wasn't medical fit, and they were all about 300. We lost about 300 out of the regiment, and for the ones that were in it, we had to make up new friends because they're making new recruits, and we had to make new buddies again because we lost. I've lost two of my best friends that had a, they had their discharge, and they were sent to the depot. So then, my brother, Bill, he had to, he went in trying to get into the Navy that time, but they wasn't taking anybody in. So, his friends were in the Halifax Rifles, and so I said, well, if you go into the Navy, I said, we'll be in different outfits. My other brothers were turned down because they were unfit, not because there was any sickness or any in the family, but one reason or another, they were turned down. So my brother Bill, his friends coaxed them into their regiment in the Halifax Rifles. So he made up his mind and he went in the Halifax Rifles, and then I heard when I got home that Bill was in the Halifax Rifles, and he used to have to come home every night until their quarters were ready on Citadel Hill. So I was up on the gun one day and I was called down. I was up there doing my watch and I was called down and had to go to the office. So I thought I was in a jam or something and got myself in Dutch. But I went up to the office and the colonel, he said, well, Gunner Ferguson, I guess we'll have to let you go. I said, on what reason? Well, he said, your brother had claimed you into his outfit. And I said, oh no. I said, I didn't want to go into the infantry. I wanted to stay with the artillery because I've been in it for 3 years and I met a lot of friends now. So he said, well, there's not much I can do about it. He said, we'll have to let you go. He said, we know we didn't have no reports or your good conduct and everything. He said, we'll just have to let you go. I said, well, I said, I'm not going to like it, but I guess I'll go. So I got back into the Halifax Rifles, and my brother was made a corporal, and we used to go out on the back country roads for guard duty, and our duty was to stop all cars going through and search for any equipment that looked suspicious or anything like that. And then while we were in the city, we used to march down to a hall they had made up for the ones that were doing duty in the city, until we got our own barracks on Citadel Hill. And then we used to go out at certain times and on different roadblocks for 2 or 3 weeks, and then come back and go back to the barracks and then just do manual drill. And so one day I was over in the officer's quarters with another chap. We were on fatigues, cleaning up glass, I guess, from the night before. And we were there washing the glasses and shining them up. So the sergeant came over, he says, Ferguson and Johnson, and he said, why don't you go back to the barracks, he said, and take all the equipment that you've got, he said, except for the rifle, you turn that into the quartermaster stores. You're on a draft to the reinforce the West Nova Scotia Regiment, Norshot, Nova Scotia. So I thought I was following my brother up. But when I arrived in Aldershot, this was in July 1940, and I looked around, but the boys told me that he was already gone. He had left about 2 weeks before I got down there. And I said to myself, boy, I never catch up with him now, and because he's already gone on the first division. So it was an hour shot up and doing my advanced training, and it was pretty hot there with sand. And we used to go out in road marches 50 to 75 miles and with full pack and come back, and then we'd get dismissed and we'd all go down and have a shower, and we had some foot baths, and after you had your feet into it, you go walk another 50 miles. It made you feel so good. But then I went on leave, on embarkation leave, not embarkation, on furlough, and I went home. And so the mother said, well, what are you doing home? So I said, well, I'm home on my furlough. So she said, oh, that's good. So you'll be home for a while. But the time went so fast that first thing you know, I was heading back to the camp. And when I got back to Aldershot, and I've seen some of the boys that was gone, so I asked one of the sergeants, and he said, oh, some of the boys have been, there have been 200 men picked out for the regiment in the Royal Rifles of Canada from Quebec. And I said, oh no. I said, not again. So I said, well, I said, I missed again. So there was three or four of us in the hut. And one fellow, my cousin, Johnny McCaffrey, he was from Cape Breton. And him and I was stayed in camp one weekend, tried to catch the officer that was in charge after his draft. And every time he come in the hut, and we'd ask him, is there any chance of getting on the draft? We wanted to get the heck out of here if we've been here too long. So he said, no, not a chance, because he said, there's 200 on the waiting list already. So Johnny and I sat down and we said, well, I don't wonder how long we're going to stick around here and just walk, marching and drilling and everything in the sand. So we did bug the officer till one morning he came in the hut, and he came over. He said, you and Ferguson wanted to go on this draft to the Royal Rifles? And we said, you bet we do. So he said, okay. He said, take your rifle and different parts of equipment to the quartermaster stores. He said, and the 200 men or so will be leaving for the Royal Rifles in a couple of days. So we were glad of that, because we knew we were getting out of there and for something new. So when we arrived, we went to New Brunswick. And first thing we knew, the regiment was there, but they were in quarantine. They were in quarantine for 2 weeks. They were ready to go to Newfoundland. And this was in the first part of December. And so when we got there, they said we wasn't allowed downtown because the quarantine, they didn't want nobody to catch it. So another fellow and I, one night, we just walked out of camp and we went downtown and we went into a pastry shop and we bought a cream pie. So when we came out, there's two sergeants coming down the street and they asked us what we were doing downtown. We said, we just thought we'd come down for a walk. So they told us, well, they said, take your walk and go right back in the camp. He said, you're not allowed down here. So we said, well, what are you fellas doing here anyway? So anyway, we got back in camp and we left and we went to Halifax, but never had a chance to see anybody because we left right from the train, right onto the boat. And we left, we head for Newfoundland. And when we arrived in Newfoundland, it was in the early part of December, and there was quite a bit of snow in Newfoundland, and we were in one place called, I believe it was Botwood, where we arrived, and we went on into a hall there, and we put down our rifles and equipment, and of course there were a lot of all the girls start to gather around and everything, because our regiment was the only second regiment in Newfoundland at the time, and they claimed some of the boys was telling us after we got in to Gander, where our outpost was, they said the first Canadian troops that arrived in Newfoundland, all the girls ran in the house and peeked out the window. Said there was something new, because the first regiment was there, they wore the kilts, and they didn't know who they were, so they ran in the house and peeked out through the curtains. So we thought, well, we wasn't going to see much of them. So we were in Gander, and it was a pretty lonely spot. All we did was do post duty and fatigues around the airport, and get a chance every other weekend to go down to Grand Falls or around Botwood there, and the people of Newfoundland there in Grand Falls and that were really, really give us hospitality. I mean, we walk in there just same as we're going in our own home. And so the Sunday night we'd head back, the train would pull into the station and we'd go back to Gander. And then in May 1941, we left Gander and headed for St. John, Newfoundland. And we spent about 5 months there, and the people in St. John, Newfoundland was very good to us, and we had picked up quite a few boys from Newfoundland that were in the British regiment there, and they were glad to get into the Canadian regiment because they would get more pay and allowance for the family. You know? And some of the boys went into the band, you know? So we were there for 4 or 5 months, and then we left there, I believe, in August, and we came back to Canada. But Newfoundland wasn't in the Confederation then. So we came back to Falcartier, and after we were there for a day, we were told that we were going down to Jamaica. And we said, boy, that's a switch from the cold country to the hot climate. And then we thought that everything was going good, but they didn't tell us to, they didn't take away our battle dress or anything. We kept our summer drill now. So that's the last word we had, that we were going to Jamaica to lead the Winnipeg Grenadiers. But we said, fine. So we pulled out of Falcartier, and I believe there was one troop train or two, and as we were going along, we were coming through Toronto and up, and some of the boys didn't know where they were going, because a lot of them knew going down east or going up west. But when we came out to past Ottawa, I said, you're not going down east, that's for sure. Because if you're going to Jamaica, you'd be going down to Halifax and taking a boat and go down to Jamaica. So I said, we must be going somewhere else, either out the west coast or somewhere. So we said, oh well, we know when we get there. So we arrived. First thing you know, we were on about four or five days on the train. We arrived in Vancouver, and first got off the train, and we marched up onto the ship. I believe the ship was named the Wateer. It was one of the boats, English ships that they brought refugees, Chinese refugees, somewhere in China. Around, and then they have cleaned it up and put bunks in there for taking troops. So we got on and we met the Grenadiers.
They were on the boat.
Yeah, they were there all that time waiting for us. We took probably be on the boat probably 2 or 3 days, maybe 4 days. And so one fella says, about time you guys got here. And then just before we left, some of the boys had jumped her and equipment that, but we didn't know really what was going on. It was just, we heard some of the boys had jumped the ship, and so the next morning we knew we were anchored in the stream, and then we were on our way, and nobody knew where we were going, if we used to ask the officer or the sergeant, or they said, well, don't know where we're going. So then the first thing we knew, we arrived in Honolulu, and they told us we had, that probably about 3 days old, we were in our summer drill, shorts and shirt, and we had candle flashes up on our shoulder, and we arrived. Before we arrived in Honolulu, we were told not to show any signs that we were from Canada, but yet everybody, even the officers, had Canada marked up on their shoulders. And we arrived in Newfoundland, and we arrived.
That sounds like the
army. So we arrived in Honolulu, and so some of the officers said, "Now remember," and we said, "Yes. What about this? It shows Canada right on there." We said, "They're not blind." So when we docked in Honolulu for supplies, water, I believe, and some vegetables and that, and so first thing you know, we couldn't believe it, but there were some officers on the ship, on the dock. We said, how in the heck did they get over there? There was nobody supposed to be allowed to get off the boat. Of course, we were up on the third deck, and looking down through from our porthole, from the room, three or four fellows trying to get their head out through the porthole. Well, you can only get about two heads out, go down. And so some of the officers were there, and the boys from the porthole had their cameras, and they were taking pictures of the Hawaiian girls, and the officers were standing alongside them taking their pictures. And one Hawaiian girl had a big red rose in her hair, and one of the boys held out, "Hey, sweetheart, I'll give you $10 for that rose you got in your hair." So that was all we heard of that. So then after a while we heard some of the boys had managed to get a bought or some way another bought a grass skirt of one of the girls after they put on a show. Hawaiian boat, there was about 25 of them, and they had Hawaiian music, and they were dancing. They had a big carpet right along the dock, and the first thing you know, the carpet was shining with silver, and they did not show any part of Canada, but there you go.
The money.
they had more money than we did.
Everything
was shining with silver, and silver was rolled up in dollar bills and things like that, and were thrown to the girls at the shore. So then finally they started playing Aloha. So it was a funny feeling that came over us when they played Hawaii Goodbye, and we were pulling out, and we heard the music until we couldn't hear no more. But I know you could see the expression on the boys' faces, that they felt like busting out and crying, you know. And they were, the song they said, the Hawaiian song that they have sang, it was something like, "Aloha, we will meet again someday." But it was a long time after that, about 4 years after, and we didn't know where we were going. So then we arrived in Manila. We stopped there for a few hours, I believe, and then we went to, after we left, that was the last place we left, and then first thing you know, we arrived in Hong Kong. So it was pretty hot there, and we got dressed in our battle order and ready for the fall in to march up on the boat to our camp, which was, we didn't know where it was. But the Royal Scots pipe band was there, and they piped us up through the streets, and all the Chinese people, and they were standing along there. They were wondering what we were doing there, and everybody was waving, and the Chinese kids were waving their hands now, and the Royal Scots played a real marching tune right up into the camp. They marched us in, and everybody that was in camp, British troops, and they were all lined up and to greet us after we arrived in the camp. And then we were there in CB for 48 hours before anybody was allowed to go downtown. And we arrived there on the 16th November, because 3 days after it was my birthday. I was 25. And so the sergeant says, well, said you might have to spend your birthday on duty. I said, well, I said, you're kidding. I said, you can't spend the night here on your birthday. So the sergeant said, well, he said, you're the one that has to do the duty for the first night. So I said, okay. So all the boys were downtown then, and I went up to the there was two rooms on the end of the, each platoon had their own hut, and the mosquito nets was rolled down under the mattress after 4 o'clock, and they had fans in the hut because it was pretty hot, pretty warm there. In the evening there were quite a few flies, the odd flies now, and they didn't want to take any chance because they say some of the flies were kind of poison and that. So I walked up and down the hut there and nobody around. So I went up to the sergeant's room. Sergeant Marshall, he was one of the boys that were in Aldershot, Nova Scotia, with me. And so I went up and I turned on the radio, and you know, all you could get was Chinese music. So he couldn't understand any of it. So I said, well, hey, I'm going to do something. So I got Sergeant Marshall's tunic and I put it on, and I said, I'm going over to the NAFI. That's where they buy drinks now, and beer. So I went over, and the Chinese waiter came over, and he was 6 foot. And I asked him if I could get a bottle of rye. And he said yes, because the NCOs could go over and get what they want and just sign the chip, but they pay for it later on. And so I had Sergeant Marshall's sergeant's tunic on, and he's taller than I am, quite a bit taller. So anyway, the Chinese boy gave me the quarter rye, and I paid him for it, and I went back to the hut. And I said, well, I'll have a drink for my birthday anyway if I don't get anywhere else. So I took it, and I took a toast myself and one for the sergeant for his tunic. So, but the next morning, the sergeant usually go over there in the morning and have a drink, and then because we only drill half a day because it was too hot. After 1 o'clock, it was about 120-125, and the British commander there wanted us to drill all day, but Major Brigadier Lawson, he told the British commander that he would look after his own troops, and Brigadier Lawson would look after his. And he said if he wanted to work, drill his men all day, he would. But he said these men are not used to one country, so he said they're drilling half a day. And he said, but they won't be allowed out till 4 o'clock. They can hang around the hut and do their clothes or whatever they want to do. But they're only going to drill half a day. So we were glad of that, because it was so darn hot that you couldn't go outside half the time unless you had really something on your head. And the Chinese boys used to come around with ice cream and that. And then as time went on, and then one Sunday, we were waiting to go downtown. And when it was time, we all left camp and went down. I was going into a show, and I was just going to buy my ticket and going in to see one of the Wallace Berry pictures that was on there. It was a pretty old one, I guess, supposed to be a Cuban picture or Mexican. And all of a sudden I heard a holler, and I looked around, and here was the sergeant and provost telling us to go back to camp. And I said, what for? He said, don't know, but that's the orders. Everybody back to camp. So I just put the ticket back on the window and just turned around and went and got into a rickshaw and drove back to camp. And of course, when it charged me 20 cents, but I think the driver wanted to get 50 cents out of me, but I told him, might see him later, but that was a lot later. So we got back to camp, and they told us we were 24 hours CB for until such time they get other news. So we sat around the hut there, and the sergeant said, well, it may not be too long. He said, you may have to go, might be able to go downtown again. So we waited and waited, sit around with our battle.
Did they tell you anything at all?
No.
Did you have any idea what they were talking about?
No. We didn't know why we were in Hong Kong. We didn't know why we were there. And so then we found out that we were on an expeditionary force training. We were spent 6 months in Hong Kong and go to Singapore and go to India and back to Canada. But it didn't go that way. And so we got news about 2:00 in the afternoon to fall out in full marching order, except for our kit bags and that, and the boys was left behind they would pick them up and take them over to the colony. We were on the mainland, so we marched down to the ferry boat, and we just got across over to the island when the Japs came over and started machine gunning and bombing the camp and around. And some of the boys that were, they said they got underneath the bed and that, and the late Chinese woman and her daughter that was doing the tailor work for our boys in our hut, they had one tailor for each hut. The boy said they were shot down by bullets from the Japanese plane. And they were around for about an hour or two, and then they took off. And then they finally got back over the island. Some of the boys got back, but some of the boys were left behind because they were dead in the hut. And so we got on the island, and then the first thing we had to work is to get things set up, our roadblocks, and they had pillboxes built in the mountains there. They had about the beds, they hung down from the wall like bunk with chains on the end. And the pillboxes, they hold about maybe 4 or 5 men. They're built right in the rock. And they had a narrow path going up to them. And they had steel doors and steel windows on them, but it was sure hot in there when we used to close the door and the window. Because we didn't know what was going on. So then we got word that there'd be no light at night showing, and we had to do everything in the dark. And we were trained for that before, in case we had no light that we practiced on. Your rifle, if you know to have the right rifle and your equipment, that, so everything was there. And you put right, we'd know where to get it, and you put your hand right onto it. So then we used to, we were short of men, and we used to have to do double duty. And then the new recruits that we had, some of them were very shy. They didn't want to go on their watch by themselves because they were scared to go, or they were too young. A lot of them were a lot younger than we were. Some of them were only 15 when we picked recruits have come across over to Vancouver.
Were some of them not too well trained?
A lot of them had a week's training. I mean, a lot of them never seen a rifle until they landed on the boat or in Hong Kong. And that was, we were in Hong Kong only about 3 weeks from the wars when the Japs attacked us. So we figured that the new recruits, the boys that didn't have no training, would have a pretty rough time, more than we'd have. And they were shy, and the places they couldn't move them if you had a hold of them. They just froze there. And so the older boys had to watch, had to look after them and look after their equipment and guide them like a brother. But when the Japs started to come over and start bombing that, well, a lot of them got killed because they wasn't trained for to take cover, and that they would go over the opening, you know. So and we used to have to go leave our hut and go down the path off the mountain and get down on the main road. And of course, with us, we had boots with steel triggers in our heels, in the boots, and that was, you walk along the road at night or at 2 o'clock in the morning when everything is still, you can hear it for miles coming. And the Japanese, well, they had runners, and you couldn't hear them, for they could be right up on you before you know it.
Were they gorillas?
Yeah, they wore runners, and split-toe runners, you know. They could climb trees and everything. So us with big boots coming down the road, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, you could scare anybody out of sleep. So so we used to have to leave, and I had one young fellow with me, and we had to go at 2 or 4 o'clock in the morning, leave our hut or our pillbox and go down the hill and go along the road and cross over and get over on the other side, so we can, there was a bay on the other side of the hill, and we had to go and relieve the other two fellows that were there. And we were told if we seen anything that was suspicious looking, for one of us to come back. Of course, you had to go through a small path, and which we had hooked up along the trees, along the path, that you could see. We had tin cans tied on thin wire, so if anybody did come up to the bank, we know it wouldn't be any of our boys, it would be the enemy. So that nobody was supposed to know about these booby traps that we had fixed up along the road going to the other side of the hill. So when I was on watch with Buddy, he just stood there, and while we were looking down and watching around, couldn't see very much because it was pretty dark. And then the first thing we seen was three fires in a triangle, sort of a signal to somebody. And we sort of, it wasn't us. So whoever was down there was making signals to the enemy that there was troops up here. So I said to the young fellow, I said, well, you better go back and report it to the officer. So he wouldn't move. I said, you better take it. I said, take your rifle and go back. Just run. I said, it's not far. I said, don't be scared. I said, I will stay here. I said, you want to stay here and I'll go. He said, no. Well, I said, one of us got to go and report this. So it just happened that one of the boys came up from the hut where we were staying there. And I said, boy, I'm glad somebody came along. I said, because as he wouldn't go, and I said I would go if he'd stay here alone, and he wouldn't. So I said, so the fellow said, well, what is it? I said, look down on the shore there. And he said, well, what's that? I said, well, see the three fires? They look in the triangle shape. There's one on the point, one on both sides. I said, that don't look very good. So he said, well, he said, you stay here and with him, and he said, I'll go back and tell the officer in charge. And I said, fine. So he went back, and the officer and a couple more men came up, and so we went back and we got our equipment together, and we all went on that side of the hill and watched. And the officer said, well, can't be very much, or they would have been doing more action than what they are doing now. But he said, we'll have to be on the alert. So then a friend of mine named Walter from Camp Lawshaw. Him and I used to have to, we had a place built up on the side of the road, made of sandbags, like a post, and with our rifle, and we had a, him and I had to look after, Walter and I had to look after this anti-tank rifle, and we used to say to the sergeant, well, can somebody else take turn, and Walter and I, so we can do something else. And the sergeant said, well, there's only you and Fergie here and a couple more that knows anything about the anti-tank rifle, and the rest of them don't know anything about it. Well, he said, well, we'll look after that anti-tank rifle. And I said, then let them carry the ammunition. I said, well, I said, yes, they can do something. So we can't carry everything. So it finally ended up where Walter and I, Wally and I end up carrying our own rifles and the anti-tank rifle, which was pretty heavy for one fellow, but one fellow had to carry it, because one fellow had to carry the cocktail bottles that they had made up for explosive, you know, for any tanks that came along the road. They had two special matches attached to the bottle that you light them and attach and light the wick, and then count three and then post it, throw it to the tank, and they could post it, burn the tank out. But there was no tanks to be burned up because the Japs never used any. And the British there had a few beam gun carriers and that. We would have had our tanks and that if they would have arrived before us in Hong Kong, but fortunately, our equipment arrived in Manila a week before we got to Hong Kong, pretty short, because when we got to Hong Kong, we had no equipment, only what we had on the boat, and that was only rifle and machine gun, and you can't do very much with a machine gun, when the Japanese start flying down low and machine gunning and that, and then they turn, we were told that by the officers, try to shoot them down with your rifle. Well, yeah, that'd be a pretty crack shot to shoot a fighter plane coming down with a machine gun, trying to use a rifle. So we stuck it out, and the Japs were over every day, and we had the Portuguese Hong Kong volunteers. They were a pretty good bunch, and they were doing first aid work. So we were up, there was two Portuguese boys, myself, were sitting alongside the hill one day, and we opened up a couple of cans of soup with our bayonet, and we dumped the soup in our helmet, and we were trying to eat our soup, and the Japs were bombing, and one of the boys said, I wish they'd stay away until I had my soup finished, because it was rocking in my helmet. And the soup was going back and forth, you know. And every time the bomb dropped, well, you had to hold on to your helmet and try to drink your soup at the same time, you know. So, anyway, the Japs had bombed around and tried to knock us out. And then they dropped pamphlets saying that if we didn't surrender, this is what would happen to us. It was wounded soldiers and one fellow trying to help them along. But Brigadier Lawson, He stuck to his word and told the Japanese that we came down here to protect the island and to protect to the last man. And because they claimed that the Japanese came over three times in a boat and asked us to surrender. And we said, our head office said no. But I don't know what day it was, but it was on the 21st or the 20th. Or the 22nd, the head office, they were in a hotel, they had their headquarters in a hotel, and they were bombed out, so they lost the whole quarters, I believe, Brigadier Lawson and his staff, they were bombed out from the Japanese.
Was he injured?
No, they were killed altogether.
The whole bomb. Officers?
Yeah. I believe the bomb hit the Japanese.
Direct hit.
So then, we were fighting on hill. This business in Hong Kong was just like a guerrilla warfare, because half the time we didn't know where the Japs were and they didn't know where we were, and we every once in a while we'd run into a bunch of Japs in the group, but we had to split up because we didn't have enough men, because we had to cover the island. And so on the 21st December I was up on I was in the platoon section on Red Hill, and we were firing at some Japs, the group of Japs that was down on the side of the hill, and I find myself lifted off the ground, and I knew that I got hit, and but I didn't move, and one of the men, Keldo, came over and says, "How bad are you hit?" So I said, "I don't know." I said, "I just lift myself off the ground." So he went over and told a young British officer that didn't wear no helmet or nothing, just a bandolier and a rifle. And I thought he was a pretty brave young British officer, because he knelt down. He never got down on his stomach. He got down on one knee and fired. And then after he said we would evacuate down off the hill. He said so we can get me down to the road. So one of the boys took the bayonet and cut the cord on the respirator that we had. I don't know why we were wearing respirators and down there, and nobody used them. So they cut that off, and one of the boys looked in the respirator. He said, "Boy," he said, "that was close, George." He said, "The bullet has gone right down through the respirator. It split the container right in two, and just came down to the right part of my chest and down in out to the knee of my pants, which it was kind of ballsy, and I think only for that it would have went through my knee." And the boy said, "That was lucky." I said, "Yeah." So they got me down the road, and they put me up beside the wall, and then the ambulance came down, and the two British medical boys came over, and he said, "How would you like to have a drink?" I said, "Boy," I said, "that tastes good." But he had a bottle of gin. He said, "I'll give you, take a drink." He said, "Not too much." So I took a drink, and I grabbed a hold of the bottle. He said, "No, no." He said, "One good drink is good as a whole bottle." He said, "That's got to do." He said, "May not be able to get any more." So I had a good mouthful, and that seemed to cool me down a bit. And then they put me in the ambulance, and the driver had to drive all the way down the road. It was quite a distance from where we were, and there were snipers firing at the ambulance. I guess the Chinese thought, the Japs thought that the driver was on the right hand side, but he was on the left side, and he drove all the way down backwards down the road, going like hell, I guess, so they say. And then we got through down to they had a Chinese college. It looked like a Chinese college, but they turned it into a first aid post. And they put me up on the table, and we wore old coveralls, which I don't know how they ever wore coveralls in Hong Kong. I don't know, because it was darn hot there. It was bad enough wearing shorts and that. So the nurse there, the British nurses, I guess they looked like they were in the First World War, but they were pretty good nurses. And one of them just took the scissors and ripped up the leg on my coveralls and cut them right off, and then got half my jacket off, and then got to the wound where I was wounded, and they just took cut the skin that was loose skin off, and he said, "This might hurt a little bit," because he said, "We can't put you to sleep because we have nothing to do it with." So they just took a needle and thread, and one fellow got up down by my head, and he held my head, and he said, "It won't be long," he said, "before they'll have it all fixed up for you." And they sewed my chest up, and then they bandaged it up, and then I was, they put me in a room with two other fellows. We were in a room, and the room was right alongside the road. And we knew the Japs was around outside because they were still firing and shooting and that. And one, they
hit.
My bed was right by the window, and could hear them shooting and firing outside there, and could hear the Japs hollering out. So then all of a sudden, while it happened so fast, that we didn't know what happened. I guess it was a trench mortar bomb that the Japs had fired, and it hit the room where we were in. And well, we didn't see nothing for a minute. Everything was just full of dust, and the walls just came in to meet, and they just expanded, and they kind of went back to their own position again. And then Major McCauley, he just came in. He was one of our majors. He just came in before that, and he got his left arm almost blown off with a hand grenade. And he was in the corner, just opposite from the door, and there was another fellow across from me. And then when this happened, and first thing you knew, when the dust and everything was all over, we were all on the floor. We didn't know we were on the floor or not. It happened so fast, and it just rolled me right out of bed, and I didn't feel nothing. I didn't know if I was wounded or nothing. So then I couldn't get up because of my chest was got real sore. And then the orderlies came in, and they helped us up, and they took us outside into the main room. There was a large room outside, and a lot of the beds were taken, but we were put under the bed. The ones who were pretty bad wounded, and they put the mattress and let under the other man's bed. So we had to stay like that, and we didn't know how long. But then that night, when everything was quiet, there was no shooting or anything, just the odd fire, and they had one little light on the table to try to make as light dark out as possible. And so one of the boys, I don't know which one, started to scream, and they said, "God said shut that man up before they come in and get us all." And so he screamed for a while, but some of the boys, he quieted up so quick, they said they must have gagged him, and they must have put tape on his mouth or something, because he was probably going into a hysterics or something. So everything was quiet that night, and this was Christmas Eve. And so that afternoon, all the boys that was able to walk around, and Sergeant Marshall was lying down in bed, and I didn't know, I forget what went wrong with him, but I was kind of stooped over, kind of my chest, and he asked me if I got hit bad. I said, "Well," I said, "not too bad," and I said, "I'm able to walk around." So they put us upstairs. It was like upstairs, like a balcony with wide steps, and we lied down on them, stretched out on the steps for a rest, and then we were up there all night. And then early part of the morning, we were half asleep and half awake, and didn't know what was going to go on. But then all of a sudden, we heard voices in the back and footsteps, and we knew for sure that the Japs had got into the hospital. And then they got up the back steps. We didn't know there were back steps upstairs, because it was a college, and upstairs was like a balcony, so they could look down, it was open in the center. And they came up, and first thing you know, we seen flashlights coming down on us, and then we got up, and they start to fire. And one of the boys, I know he lives up in the Gaspé Coast, he went to open the door so we could get downstairs, but we knew that we had it because all the Japs were all around us. And he opened the door, and the Jap fired at him and got him on his right wrist. His bullet went right through his right wrist, and he had to hold on to his hand until he got downstairs. And we got down, and he told us to put our hands up. Well, I could only put one up because my right arm, I couldn't raise it very much. So they got us all together, and there was fellas were dead, laying on the steps and lying over the tables where they'd been shot. And some of the patients that were operated on for appendix, and some of them were wounded. They were on top of the bed, and they didn't get up. I guess the Japs thought that they wasn't going to get up for them, but they claimed that they were just lying there. So the Japs had just turned around and put the bayonet to them, and they never did get out of the bed. So then they rounded all of us up, the nurses and the doctors, and they pushed us all. We had to go through a door, and there was a guard on each door. There were these fellows that came in. I guess they were more guerrillas because they wasn't regular troops, because they were half tanked out. They were drinking, and so they put us all in one room, like a storeroom, and there was cases and cases of crackers and chocolate bars and everything all piled up. And the British used, the nurses now, during the day, used to give us a half a bar because they said they had to hold on to their ration. But when we got into the store, we said, holy cow, look at all those cases of crackers and cases of chocolates and everything in there. They said, the Japs are going to have a good feast now. And they made us all sit down in there. And then when the Japs found out about the chocolate bars and the crackers and that, they just took off their helmet and filled their helmets up. And said, there, that's the end of that. So that's the last of the chocolate bars we'll see. So they kept us there for a couple of hours. And there was a Chinese girl there, and she was trying to bandage up this fellow's wrist that got shot from Gaspé Coast. And she bandaged it up somehow, and then she took off her scarf or her bandana, whatever you call them, and she put it around his arm and tied it like a sling, so until it wouldn't hurt. But they took the girl aside, and we heard a scream. I guess they have tortured her and killed her. But that night they moved us all upstairs in different rooms, and there was one room where I was in, and this fellow got Coast and our padre Burnett. He was in the room, and they claimed there was about 90 of us in one room that were all wounded and everything, and they made us put a blanket up over the window so we wouldn't get no air or nothing. But we used to try to pull the blanket aside, but the air was pretty still because it's so hot. And we stayed there all that day, all Christmas Day, and they didn't give us no water or anything. And some of us were just dying for thirst, and we couldn't move. Some of the boys wanted to sit down because some of the boys had bad legs, they had wounded. One fellow had a bullet right through his knee, and he had a bandaged up, but he couldn't lie down because there was too many in the room. So out by the window, and there was two sergeant majors in the British regiment, and their wives were there, and they were nurses. And they came upstairs, and they were standing by the door, and they tried to get over to see their husband, but the Japs, these two little Japanese, they were feeling good, and they came up and they slapped the nurses back and forth in the face and pushed them out and made them go down the stairs. But their husband was saying, I hope nothing will happen to them. But then they were, while we were in the room, and that night everything was going on, and there had been raping and killing, and there was like a bloodbath in the hospital the next day when we got up, when that we slept that night, because they have taken some of us out of the room and put in another room. But when the war finished at 7 o'clock that night, when the governor surrendered the island, and it was a half an hour after when we heard that they came up and said Canada and Japan friends now. So that day, we could look out the window and see the Japs that had taken over the hospital. They just move on to another place, I guess, and the regular troops come in and they take over, because they don't have to do all the mess that they did. They do the cleaning up, and the regulars just do the guard duty. So, but some of the new Jap guards that took over on Christmas Day, some of them could talk English, and they asked us if we had any water. We said no, we had no water since Christmas Eve. So they came up, they went downstairs, and the two tall Japanese army people came up, and they had something like a baby bathtub full of water, but it was full of mud with it. But we didn't care, because they gave us English cups, big English cups, and the boys just dipped the cups in mud and all, and drank the water. I know I had two cupfuls, but our stomachs were so burned up and everything that it sure felt good, but it was really cold. But we didn't know what the mud was going to do to us, but we drank it anyway. And they laughed at us because we were drinking muddy water. So then they took it away, and that was all the water we got until the next day, when a Japanese sergeant I guess he was a medical, because he had a Red Cross on his arm and that, and he came up and he started looking at our wounds, and he asked me what happened, and I told him, and he said, not very good. I said, no. Well, he said, maybe a little while. He said, we'll put you up. We'll send you all up to the main hospital. He said, all your doctors and nurses are there, but he said, our Japanese Imperial Army have taken over Hong Kong, and he said, they should have never did this. He said, they just taken a prisoner. But he said, nothing we can do about this. He said, that they're on their own. And what they get, it's their own. They don't get paid because they're guerrillas. So the next day they took us out in trucks and they moved us up to the what they call Bone Road Hospital. And it was the regular Army hospital, and all the doctors, British doctors, Army doctors, and Army nurses, and volunteers from 200 volunteers from downtown in Hong Kong, they came up to help with the wounded and that were coming in by truck. And like there was two girls to each patient come down, and they helped you up to the ward. And we never, I don't think we slept for about 3 or 4 days. And I know for one that when they put me on the bed in the ward, I just fell asleep. And I didn't know nothing until later that night when I woke up. And it just seemed like a dream. But it looked so good that to see nurses walking around and no Japs falling with their bayonets chasing them and like that. And I was told after that I was so asleep that the girls have given everybody a bath that came in, or a sponge bath, and I had a bath, but I didn't know nothing about it. And the girls said, you must have been real tired. And I said, well, I said, we didn't sleep very well for the last 3 or 4 nights. So she said, you really slept because we gave you a bath and we had hot tea and everything for you, but you never woke up. So we didn't know if you were going to wake up or not, but since you woke up, as soon as I woke up, they asked me if I was hungry, and I said, yeah. So they said they'd be right back. There was two Hong Kong volunteer, like Chinese or Portuguese girls, looking after each patient for a while until they got up on their feet. And so they came back and they gave me a big cup of hot tea and some pudding. I don't know what kind of pudding it was, but it sure tastes good anyway. And then from then on, things were getting a little better, but we had to just carry on as we could on the ration, and until May, May 42, when they took the Japs took all the nurses and everybody out the hospital, put them in internment camps, and they just let the British orderlies and the doctors there. And when they took the nurses out, and then they put them in internment camps, well, it wasn't the same. I mean, it seemed to be when you have a nurse around, or like First World War nurses around, and when they come around and know like an old elderly one that came around every night and used to tuck us in and used to say good night, my son. But when they all left, it just, everything died down. Everything was just quiet, because it's not the same when you get the nurses now around to pet you up and that, you know. So we stayed there. And then after I got, I was there for 3 or 4 months.
Tell me, excuse me, did the Japanese interfere in any way with the running of the hospital?
They just let them control it.
What did you use for food and rations?
Well, they had rice, mostly rice, and then sometimes they used to bring up, they used to have some wild cherries. The Japs used to bring in wild cherries to the hospital, and the cuckoos used to, they'd cook it up. I don't know, they just boil it. And we used to get a couple spoonfuls of cherries with the rice, and sometimes they would mix the cherries up in the rice, try to make it different. But then one time they brought in some rice flour. It was kind of a brownish color. And our sergeant major that was looking after our ward, he said, we're going to have pudding for supper. And we said, pudding? What do you mean, pudding? He said, oh, we got his rice here and potato tops and things like that. No, he said, we're going to have some pudding tonight. So we said, okay, it sounds good. So then that night, when they got a ration, so many to each ward, I guess the ward I was in, we had about 50 or more. And so they cut the pudding up, and we got a slice of pudding. It was about half an inch thick. But I think one piece would have done just one piece, but just as good as a whole pudding, because it was heavy. And when you took a bite of it, and it just dropped in your stomach. It was so heavy. I don't know what was in it, but it was real heavy, and it was dark. And they put, I guess might have been the wild cherries that they had in it that made it heavy. But we didn't want any more of it, because nobody had any use for any more, because their stomach was, they didn't feel their stomach very good after. So then they didn't make any more. No, they used just to give the cherries, cook up the cherries and give it out with the rice and that. And sometimes they used to make, the cuckoos used to make up chow mein and stuff like that, like rice and greens mixed up, and serve it out like that. And then at the odd times, the Japs used to come in and tell the sergeant of the ward that they're going to have some apples come in. but we didn't see the apples yet. But anyway, we don't know what they had the next day, because we were, they told us once we were getting up and walking around, was they were getting ready to put us in the internment camp. So when we left the day for internment camp, we went into the camp. Well, the first camp we were into was North Point Camp, and they had a bunch of, they had quite a few hundred of Chinese refugees in there. And so the boys that were in there when we got there told us there were thousands of Chinese in there, and they had to, when the Japs took them out, the boys had to get hot water and everything, try to scald the bed bugs and everything that was in the hut. And they done that every day, and because the huts were old wooden English bunks, and then we tore all the stuff off it except for the wood part, and we scoured them out every day, and we get hot water and scoured the hut out until we got rid of the bed bugs and that. And then some of the fellows said they shouldn't have done that, because we could have got some of them to, and seen them had a game with them, seen them chasing one another, you know. So they said, no, there's only breed more. So they said, we get rid of them all. So so then we had rations for quite a while of our own. We had crackers and cheese and jam and that. But as time went on, that was getting short. And then it got down that we were getting rice for our meal. And there wasn't much of that. So, and then we used to be going out on working parties and that. And then the guard that used to go down on the truck with us, and after we were finished loading the truck downtown, like one day we went down and we had to roll, there was only four of us, and we had this, we had to put four rolls of this printing paper up on the truck. And those rolls of paper were pretty big, and it would take eight men or more to carry one. But there was only four of us, and we had to roll four of these roll of paper up on the truck. And we got one halfway up, and it came down and knocked one of the boys down, and the guard got after it because he thought we were fooling around. But I guess we wasn't strong enough to get it up on the truck, but we finally did. And then after we did, we put the backup on it, and then he told us to sit down. And then when we went to sit down, he told us to stand up. So we stood up, and then we got up on the truck, and on the way back to camp, he took out two cigarettes, and he split the cigarettes. One cigarette and two, and gave us half one, but we figured out half was better than none, you know. So we got back to camp, and then later on they moved us back to our own barracks in San Japo.
How did you feel? Were you getting better? Were you better than? Was your wound
gradually? The wound was open for quite a while because of the movement and everything, you know. And the doctor said if I could be able to lie down as much as possible, but he said, I don't think you'd be able to. He said, because I think the Japs is going to have you fellas on the move all the time. So it didn't give me much chance of getting my wound healed up. And so we went back to San Japo, and we straightened out our huts. Some were blown apart, and the water and everything was all smashed and everything. So then we just had to do the best of it. But times were really hard because they had no cook hosts, and they had big tanks. And while there was, I'd say, about 8,000 or 9,000 men left, and they had two or three of these big tanks, and they used to have to build a fire underneath them and fill the tanks up with cold water. And it used to take hours for the water to get hot before they put the rice in and cook the rice. And if it rained, they didn't get anything because they couldn't make no fire, because they were trying to get a cook house built up. or take one of the huts and build it into a cookhouse. But it went on, this went on for a long, long time. And when you got your, you say, your breakfast, you had to fall in line again because the time you got up, it was supper time. And you just sit in line from, just like you're in line all day long for your breakfast and supper, but hoping that it didn't rain. Because it took hours for the fire to get the hot water going in those big tanks. And then the Japs used to bring the rice in, and they used to just throw the bags right there and say, there's your ration, do whatever you like with it, you know. So they had to measure the rice out so every man would get equal. But sometimes the bags used to break open, and some of us used to take rice and put it in our pocket, and then like later on at night we used to build a fire outside the hut and cook the rice in our mess tin, get water, put in the mess tin and put the rice in it, and get scraps of wood around the camp and build a fire to cook the rice, and until the guards didn't like the idea and they thought we were stealing the rice, and we got banged around on the head that day, so we didn't want to do it anymore because they thought we were stealing the rice, but the rice was all over the ground and everybody was taking it. But I guess somebody one time or another has to take the beating. But then in 43, when they start moving the boys, 42, they start moving the boys to Japan. And in groups, there were 50 in group, and they said they were going on Japanese maru boats, and that, and they had to wear white gloves so they wouldn't dirty the railing on the ship. We say that was a big deal. So they had Red Cross parcels when they left camp now. But we knew we were going sometime, so they took everybody that left. They got out of the camp, all except the officers were left behind, and the boys that were in the hospital. And the ones they took, they just make the walk across the road and swing your arms and that. And as long as you can swing your arms and walk, you're okay to work. So they line you, put you down, and you're on your way to Japan. So I was on the draft with these, there was 500 of us. And they told us we were going on a maru boat and we were going to wear gloves and sneakers so the people in town wouldn't hear us marching down the street. And so we were supposed to get Red Cross parcels, and we got money from the Canadian government, from the people of Canada, and it came to by, well, the Japanese money then when we got it, but I guess they got paid in gold after. And then we got money from the Hong Kong Red Cross, and we said, gee, what are we going to do with all this money? There's no canteen or none. So the officer said, well, maybe you can use the canteen that we have. The officers had a canteen, they could buy stuff every once in a while when the canteen comes in, Japanese canteen, and they got paid after a while from the Japanese, from the Geneva Red Cross, that they said that officers must be paid while they're a prisoner. But I guess the government has to pay them after in gold. But when we got up to the canteen, we bought a few eggs and cans of jam and stuff like that. But it sure was expensive when you pay 10 cents for a small chicken egg. And a can of jam was $3 and a cup and some cigarettes.
How much money did you get?
We all got the same. We got 20, I think it was 30, 34, $35, I think, from the Canadian, from the people of Canada. And then we got $24 from the Hong Kong Red Cross.
Was that a month?
No, that's all the money we had. They gave us that because we were going to Japan. They thought it would help us to buy some extra food and stuff, which we couldn't. Well, we got it, all right. We got what we wanted on the money. But when we got on the boat, and we were down to the dock, and we all lined up there with all our things now, and we were looking for this big passenger boat that was supposed to go to Japan with, and we were saying, well, where is it? So the gangway was out already, and all of a sudden the sergeant, the Japanese sergeant, started to holler, told us to line up and everything, and he said, he pointed to the boat which we were supposed to go on. And when we looked at it, we said, oh no, not that boat, that's only a tug. Said they must have pulled that out of the water in Hong Kong and just fixed it up and put a Chinese crew on it, because there was only two hatches on the boat. It was only a coastal boat. So they started nurses aboard, and we thought we were going down on the deck somewhere, and here we were going in a hole. Steps going down into a hole, and the hole wasn't big enough to carry cargo. And there was 250 in each hole. And when we all, when 250 got down there, well, we were like sardines. We were lying one just together like sardines. And all our clothes and everything was, the only place we had was underneath our head. And because you couldn't move. At nighttime, if you moved, well, somebody else had to move so you could turn on your side or like that. And then when we got out, they covered the hatch over. They put the boards down and covered that over with the canvas and everything. And it was just like human cargo going out. And they said that they wouldn't open it up until we got outside the limit. And it was quite a while before they took the canvas off, and they took three boards off the hatch, and then they hauled down that 50 men at a time, like it was 50 men in a group, could go up on deck for 20 minutes for fresh air. Well, it was all right to be up on deck for 20 minutes, but as soon as you hit the half the steps coming down in the hatch again, you're just bad, just you're no better off. Because you started to perspire again, and everybody was just using a towel for a fan or wiping their face, because we were just, perspiration was just coming out of us like nothing, and it was hot, and it was only two portholes, and in our hatch, and I guess it was the same in the other, because they had 200, there was 500 men all together, 250 men in each hatch. And we were like that for 10 days, going across. And then when we left Hong Kong, they gave us buttons, there was eight buttons for each man. And we had MV stew, which was, we thought, well, we were going to be all right for 10 days till we get to Japan. But after we got out, the buttons and everything started to get moldy now, because of the heat and everything, nothing would stay. And we thought we were going to get MV stew and our rice. Well, it wouldn't be too bad. But when the Japs turned around and took all our rations, our sugar and MV stew, and just turned around and gave us rice twice a day, which we were supposed to get three meals a day on the way over, but we only got two meals a day, and that was only rice because the Japs had taken our sugar and MV stew. And then when we were sitting up on deck, we used to, at lunch hour, we used to see the Japanese cook that walking up the deck to the quarters where the Japanese officers that were, the stew was going up to them, and we were getting the rice, and that's all we had, and then there wasn't much we could do about it. Just eat it and keep quiet. And so we thought, they said 10 days, but we arrived in Formosa and we stopped there. They anchored there. They said they were going to be there for 2 days in Formosa Bay. We were there about, been there 10 days. And then Royal Navy interpreter, he knew we had a few dollars left on us, and he said, he would try and get the Japanese officer to go ashore and see if they can find some meat and some vegetables. He said he couldn't guarantee it, but he said he'd try. So the next day he asked us for whatever money we had, and if we wanted anything, like cigarettes, or he said if they had cigarettes, my dad, he would try and get them. But he said, don't count on it. So he said the Japanese officer and them could go ashore. So they went ashore on the motorboat, and they were gone for a couple of hours. And they came back, and I think we gave them what we told them to get what they could, and so he came back, and he had four cases of Spanish onions, and four cases of looked like grapefruit, like the red inside, this red grapefruit, you know. And so he said that's all we could get. He said, and the meat, he said, don't be surprised if you get stewed and you don't find any meat in it, because he said everything is rationed on Formosa. And he said it wasn't impossible for any to get, but he said, I was lucky enough. He said, all you get was 75 pounds of meat for 500 men. So he said, that's it. So he said, if you find a piece of meat, big as your fingernail, he said, you're lucky. So we didn't say anything. We just thought it was better than nothing. So then he said, and I got a few packed cigarettes, I guess for each man. He said, that's all you get. So we said, well, we thought that was pretty good of him to get over and get what he got. So that night we were sleeping, and we couldn't put the onions and that down the hat down in the store, so we'd keep an eye on it, because they had a Chinese crew on the boat, and they were watching us every day. And so we had to leave the onions and that up on deck under the canvas, so it'd be cool enough up there and down the hatch. But the next day when we got up, and the sergeant went to check the onions and that, like we got two onions and two grapefruit that day, and we just eat them as they were, took the peelings off and eat them as they were. And then, but there was two cases of onions missing and two cases of grapefruit missing. And there wasn't much we could do about it, because the Chinese had taken it during the night. So they waited for a few days. We left Formosa they were waiting for a convoy, and they met the convoy. We got into a convoy for a couple of days, and then we left the convoy. We were on our own. So the Chinese were selling the onions and grapefruit back to us for 10 cents apiece. So we said, well, what could you do about it? I mean, they were the Japanese, and we're by ourselves, and that was it. So the boys had to turn around and buy their own onions and grapefruits back for 10 cents apiece. So it was late at night. I guess one of the boys needed wanted to light up a cigarette, and the portholes were open. There was no windows on them, no glass or anything. So it was pretty dark. And I guess if anybody lit a match on it, you could see it for miles. And especially as any Japanese submarines around, and I mean, one light will be boom. And it would only take one torpedo because of a small boat. But he lit the match, and everybody hollered, put that light out before you kill us all. So he blew the match out anyway, and we just held our breath, because we thought, well, at any minute we were going to be blowing up an American submarine or something like that, because we were just in a spot where right in the middle of the Pacific going to Japan, and American submarines around, and anything could have happened. But I guess we got to Japan, and we could relax, because we were on land again. And
how many days did you get from Formosa to Japan?
Took us, it was supposed to take us 10 days. We wasn't supposed to stop in Formosa. It was supposed to take us 10 days from Hong Kong to go to Japan, so So it took us a little longer, about 14 days, you know. And it was a small, it was a, just an old junk boat. And we got to, when we got to Japan, and they lined us up, and they put us on trolleys or buses, and they pulled the shades down, so we wouldn't see anybody, see the town or anything. And they took us to the station, and they made us all sit down there. He said, all sit down and rest, he said, till the train comes in. So we sat there, and there was Japanese people going back and forth, Japanese girls, and they were looking and laughing, and because the way they were dressed, we were all dressed different. The way all whatever clothes we had what was on us. And we had winter supply, like we had our battle dress, and some had winter. I had English outfit, because all my stuff was lost when I was captured. And so we sat there for a couple of hours anyway, and then the officer went over to the Japanese sergeant that was in charge, and then he asked us if the men was going to get in and eat. He said, how long would it be before they get in to get to the camp? And the Japanese sergeant, he didn't know, so they arranged something. So, because later on, they came around, they gave each one of us one of these little boxes was packed with white rice and pickles. So we thought, well, that looks pretty good for being on the boat, or what we had on the boat. So we sat down there and we ate the rice and pickles and that. And then they came around and they gave us some water. They gave us just a scoopful of water, and that was it. And so we got on the train, and then we got into this camp. And it was the next day we got into the camp. It looked like a new camp, because everything looked new wood and everything. So I was up in North. This was in the camp. We were the first camp we were in. The Japanese guards and we were all in the one building, and we were in each individual group was in had their own room, but you had your own square. Every man had like a mat, and you slept on that. Maybe if you had a blanket, they gave us blankets. There was five blankets and a pillow, but the pillow was made of light canvas and sawdust inside. So we were in the rooms 50, and each man had a square, and so that was there, and we didn't know what we were going to do, so we just hung around and then. Everybody, we had these, in Hong Kong, we were issued these cardigans with no sleeves in them. And I don't know how it happened, but after we arrived there later on, and everybody started to get, started to feel itchy and that. And when you're sleeping about, a couple inches away from one another, and well, the boys, we always started to get lousy, and they couldn't control it. And one day, they had the barber to cut our hair. Everybody had to have their hair cut short. So one way of keeping, trying to keep the lice away. And I was sitting there in a chair, and the guy said, "Geez, George, said you got some big fellas here." I said, "What do you mean, lice or bugs?" He said, "There were lice." And he said, "Oh, well," he said, "you're not the only one." He said, "I guess everybody in the camp got them." So he said, "They have to do something about it, because everybody's just getting full of them. They start to walk all over you, you know. They were getting big and that." So they built a lousing steam thing. So one day they told us to strip off. We strip off, and each man went along and took all his clothes off, and we put them in the steamer. And so we just hung around with a just a pair of shorts on or a towel around it until you got your clothes back. Probably took about a couple of hours. And then when you got your clothes back, they were warm. Now, but then it didn't help because it got clear. The ones were walking around, but when you got your clothes on, you got out in the sun. That the eggs that didn't even catch, they started breeding again. So everything started all over again. So then they started going around. They were burning everything that you think that had lice in it. And we burned everything and just kept what we had on us. And every day we kept washing them. And then there was no more water. And so all the water we had then was what we got out of the pump downstairs. They had two or three pumps, and it was ice water, like when you pump it out. And when we came back, they told us we got out in the yard one day and told us we were going to move to another camp. And we thought, well, here we go again. But when we were in this camp, we got some Red Cross parcels come in, and when we came in to work one night, and the boys said they got some Red Cross parcels, said they might get them after supper. So we got one parcel between seven men, and it was American parcels. And so there was three or four cans of meat and four or five packs of cigarettes and that. We thought the cigarettes were good and the meat and everything that was in the box, but when you got a box for seven men, well, all you could do was sit down in a group and open up the box and have yourself a little lunch, because that's all it's just about it. Because when you split four cans of bully beef with seven men, there's no good saving them. So we just sat down and had a good lunch. And of course we had the cigarettes and other things, but one thing we couldn't split was little cans of sugar, and so they didn't know how to split that between seven men. Well, we said maybe when we get our ration of rice, we could just go along and just put a sprinkle on each man's dish, and that would take care of that, you know. So that went on for a while, and then another time, and then they took us out one day to get some vegetables, and they took us to a place, big field that they had outside, and they were growing daikons. But daikons look like parsnips. They're long and quite big. They're, I don't know how big around now, but anyway, they taste like a turnip, and sometimes turnip tastes like wood. So we were supposed to dig them up and take them back to camp, for the Japanese and some for ourselves. And so once we got the first ones out of the ground, of course everything grows in the sand over there. And so when we got the daikon, we broke one up and we started eating it. And the guard came over and he slapped us in the face, and he said, it was no good for us to eat them, because he said they should be washed first. But he said we didn't care because we were so hungry, and it tasted good. But after a while, he said we could eat what we want, but he said don't put none in your pocket. He said or you'll be in trouble. So we picked them all out of the ground and we carried them back to camp. And I forget what camp we were in, but I don't know if we were working or not, but we were there for a while, and then they moved us out of there, and we had to walk the new camp. They were building a new camp, I guess, and so the day we moved out, we packed all our things up in the blankets. We had five blankets, but the five blankets wouldn't make one good one here, like a good wool blanket. So we packed everything up and we
we walked along like a bunch of gypsies. And so I don't know how far it was, but it was, everybody was sitting down every once in a while because our packs were so heavy and walking. And we finally came to the new camp, and they made us all stand in the yard. And so we were there and sat around, and then the big Japanese, I guess the colonel and a couple other officers and guards, and they had a big table set up there and paper and everything. So he said, so the colonel got up, I guess it was the colonel, he got up and he told us he had papers for us to sign, and he gave us a warning that if anybody escaped, we'll be shot. And he said, we'll be all going out in a day or two to work in a canning factory for working canning fish. So we thought that was a pretty good idea. We said, gee, we're going to work in a fish plant, so we thought it'd be all right. We'd be getting some fish anyway, or sniping one way or the other, because they don't allow you to take anything. So when we walked out to camp that day, and so we seen this fellow standing in the corner. He had a big black beard on him, and he was dressed in dark clothes now, and he was a real Japanese, or he looked like a real hard boss, and he had big thick glasses, and he was rubbing his hands and said, well, I got a good bunch of men here I'm going to have for a while. So when we left camp that morning to go to work, and we were looking around to see the factory, but there was no factory. All we seen was, we walked into a coal yard. We said, well, this is going to be nice. So the Japanese were all working in coal, unloading coal, boats and that. And we said, oh, and we looked at one another and said, well, I guess this is our cannon factory. So they lined us all up, and we were in groups, 50 in a group, and we had our own sergeants with us. And some of the Japanese guards, I guess they were in the First World War, they were dressed in blue uniforms with a white band, number 7 on them. So we call them number 7. They were the boss of each group. And so they say, well, come with me. So we'd go with them, and first thing I know, we went over to a shed, and he said, so many take a shovel, and so many take a basket. One man take a basket with a big bamboo stick, and there was a basket on each end, something like a hat, like the Japanese, or like the Chinese were in the paddy field. On each end of the bamboo stick, and he said, you carry coal in them. And well, we said, we never carried anything like that on our shoulders in our life. So when we seen the Japanese going running with loads of coal in the baskets, and I said, boy, they're used to it. Even the women used to they carry coal and load cars, railroad cars, and that. So we said, well, this must be what we're going to do. So then after we got our shovels and baskets, and then we got lined up, and they took us over to the coal yard, and they put us on a pile of coal, and then there was some cars come in, about 30 railroad cars, box cars, and they gave us planks, so he told us how to put the planks up, and then so he said, now you're the man, one man with basket. He said, he'll carry the coal. He said, and then he said, into the car. He said, you run up the plank. Well, the planks, just ordinary planks that they use for painting the outside of the house. Only just one plank and another one, and up to the car. And you just, one forward, load your basket up, and load it up real good. But they tried first with a shovel on each basket. And when we started to carry the coal, the baskets used to fall off our shoulder because we wasn't used to it. And everybody was doing the same. It wouldn't stay on the shoulder, so the guard, number 7s, were getting mad because they thought we could learn right away. And they were mad and getting madder all the time because we were dropping our baskets and falling off the plank. because some of us only had some of us had shoes and some of us didn't. Like myself and a couple more were in our bare feet working in a coal yard. And he said we didn't know because we couldn't get no shoes because they didn't have the size, because all they wear is fours and fives. So we had to work in our bare feet. We didn't mind the soft coal, but when we moved over to the hard coal, that we couldn't stand it, because we couldn't stand the hard coal was sticking in our feet. And then we had to run up the plank, and then we load the cars up. And after they're loaded, they had three or four men push the car down the track, way down. Maybe the first car would probably go down about, about a quarter of a mile for the first car, because there's 30 cars on the track to be loaded. And that's what we did from that time until the day we went down. And they just sat around for a while and they gave us brooms. And that's when the Americans started bombing, when they started bombing Japan. And one day they put us in the hut and they locked the door. And they didn't want us, the Americans, to see us, because they say that they're always looking out and they see that there's prisoners. So they locked us in the door in the hut, and then till after the air raid was over, and then they took us out and they gave us brooms and sweep up the coal, because the coal was getting short in Tokyo, and the boats were coming in, they were getting blown up from the mines that the Americans were dropping at nighttime. And so one day we went back to work and they sat around. So finally they told us to line up, and we lined up, and they took us back to camp. And that was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we thought it was very funny, but they said it's nice to get back to camp anyway. So we went back to camp, and we never did go out. We just hung around the camp. And so a couple of days after, the camp commandant and major fellows and a couple more, they left camp, and our interpreter, we asked him what was going on. He said, I don't know. He said, maybe they're just going to Tokyo for some reason. And so we didn't say any more, because we didn't know what was going on. And so we hung around the camp, and the rations was getting short, and the guards, we usually see the guards, there used to be about 10 guards around the camp, but every day they were getting shorter and shorter. Like the last day we only had 5 guards at the camp. And we said, what's going on anyway? So anyway, the camp commandant and the major fellows came back, and so they took us all out in the yard, and the Japanese camp commandant, a young fellow, he was half crazy, half the time running around with his sword out, and like he was going to cut a fellow's heads off of that. So he said, Canada and Japan, he said, friends, he said, we're all friends now. He said, the war is over. He said, the Allies have beaten us. So he said, it was over 5 days ago. But he said, we didn't want to tell you, boys, because he said, we didn't know what would you do. So all we did, we didn't do anything. We just looked at one another, raised our eyebrows and said, well, so he said, that's that, the war's over and the guards are going home. And then finally they kept a couple of guards around because they thought that some of the Japanese civilians might come up in camp and cause trouble and try to cause an argument with it. But we didn't see nobody. So then the next day the American plane came over, and he flew around, and there was 3 of us standing outside the hut. We was in the summertime in August, just when the war finished. And the plane came back, and he came down so low, he almost took the fence down. Of course, half the fence was down anyway, we took it down, and then he dropped, it was a big bag drop, and then it just slewed across the ground, and the must have split, because when the three of us stand alongside one another, and I don't know, we were just standing there, but we were stripped down to the waist, and first thing you know, we felt this cold stuff going right across our chest, and when we did it, it was toothpaste. That when it hit the ground, it must have hit a box of toothpaste or something, because it just squirted right across the three of us, and we smelled it and said, it's toothpaste.
Teeth left.
When Major Fellows opened it up, and he got a note and said it was from American submarine, from the boys from the American submarine, they had taken all their belongings that they had, like cigarettes and chocolates and stuff like they had on their own. They packed it all in the sea bag and sent it to you. He said, hold on. The note says, be back tomorrow, same time. And take it easy. So next day, all we seen was, we looked up and was three or four B-29s flying overhead, and the parachutes coming out like anything. And we were so glad, and you just felt like busting out and crying or something. But we didn't have time to cry. So they told us to go out and look after the parachutes that comes down, because it was loaded with supplies. He said, because some of the Jap soldiers was just waiting for it to get a hold of that stuff, you know. And so we went around and we guarded it. And the one American, big American fellow that was in the camp, he seen one of the Turks that was in the office. And we used to call him Slap Happy, because he used to always want to slap us around. And he seen him taking a chocolate bar out of the box, and he went over to him, and the American hit him so hard, I guess he must have broke his jaw or something, because he was holding on pretty tight. The Americans told him to leave the stuff alone. He said, it belongs to the men, and belongs to these men here. So they took off, and so we got well supplied with cigarettes, and we had chocolate and also milk and or anything you think of. And instead of having two meals a day, we were getting six meals a day.
How did your stomachs take it?
Well, we didn't eat all that they gave us. They told us that they dropped enough for there were some American Marines coming up that section to take over, like post duties, taking over the post around there, occupation troops, and that's why they said they dropped enough for to look after them too, or they were supposed to come up around there for they said for a short while, these American Marines. And the store that used to be a canteen was supposed to be a canteen for us one time, but there was nothing in it, only tobacco, and we used to have to wait a month for to get tobacco. They used to take it in the camp and put it in the window and let us look at it for a while, just to tease us. And we used to have to work 2 weeks to get enough to buy the tobacco. And when we were supposed to get a package, but when it was issued out to us, they only gave us a half of one, half a package. And there wasn't much you could say about it. So you just had to take the good, the better, and the sweet, I guess, what they call it. But they sure liked to tease us. So then after we got out, and we went to Yokohama, and they put us all lined up there, and the Americans went to doctors, and we went to delousing and medical, and we then went into a shower. We had a haircut, shaved, went into a shower, then we went into another room. We got American trousers and shirt and socks. We couldn't wear any shoes because our feet were so sore from working the cold now that we just walked around in our stocking feet, which nobody cared, because we were free and waiting to go home, and that we were walk around even in our bare feet. We didn't care about shoes. But we said, we'll get shoes when we get home. So we didn't mind walking around in our stocking feet. And so we got some, whatever the medical, the doctor says, if fellow's heart was bad or he couldn't travel by boat, they'd fly him home. But I was taken on the ship, what they call the Ozark, and we got on there, and we left Yokohama for the 1st September, and the first place we stopped was in Guam, and they had piles of stuff there, the Americans. They had a big storeroom, big place there with civilian suits and shoes, everything you can think of. And then American Red Cross came along, and they gave us $5 each. And but no way we could spend it. We tried to one way or the other, but no way, because everything they gave us was free. So we just kept the $5 in our pocket and forgot about it. So we were 3 days in Guam, and then we left Guam, and we stopped in Honolulu, and then we got in there about midday, and the captain of the ship, he told us we could all go ashore, but he said, we want you all back here at midnight tonight, he said, because the ship be leaving at 12 o'clock. So he said, go ashore and enjoy yourself, he said, but be back. So we all went ashore, we went anywhere. We could see there were so many places to go, but we didn't know which place to go. So I know a lot of us, we ended up at American base. We went up there, and some of the Americans came over, American Navy petty officers came over and said, you folks just come back from Japan from prison camp. I said, yeah. Well, we should all come up. There were about 25 of us in a group, I guess. We just hung around with one another, and we went up there. He told us to sit down, and we sat down, and he served us. He got some beer sent over to us, but I think all I had was just one or two cans. Couldn't take any more because didn't feel like it, because there was no room for it, because our stomach was so small. And there was lots of food there, but you couldn't eat it. He said, what's wrong with you guys? He said, you should be hungry. We said, yes, we're hungry, but we can't eat it. There was milk and all kinds of stuff. He said, rich stuff, but nobody would take it. So we had one, two cans of beer, and that was enough. So he said, we thanked him for it, and we all strolled off, and we just walked where would we end up at. So we walked and walked, and we end up at a village called Waikiki Village. And there was Hawaiian girls there, and some men then that were singing and drinking, looked like big bottles of wine, race wine, I guess. And we walked in, we just stood there, and they looked over, and they called us over, and they told us to sit down, and they asked if we were returning home from Japan prison. They said, yeah. So they told the girls to go and get some wine. So they went, and they came back, and wine girls came back with a big bottle of wine, and they gave us all a drink, and so we all sat down. They told us to sit down and listen to the music and that. So the girls put on a little show. They came over with their grass skirts on, and they put on a show for us. And they were dancing, doing the hula hoop and everything. We were laughing and everything.
I bet you
guys were
in heaven.
So it was so light there, you could read a paper at midnight. And we just walked around there, and we didn't realize we were going back to the boat, because we thought we had lots of time. But when the boat left, I guess the boat had left, but we didn't know about it. And we seen this American truck come down the road, and there was a couple of MPs on it, American MPs, and they came down and they hollered at us and they said, hey, you fellas. I said, what are you doing down here? Oh, he said, we're sitting down watching the girls dancing down. We said, lost time. He said, oh, no. He said, you know, the boat's gone. Well, we said, it's fine, we'll stay here then, you know. So he said, oh, no. He said, you fellas just hop up on the truck, and he said, we'll take it to the airport. So he said, so we went to the airport, and so we waited there, got on a B-29, went to Seattle. We stopped there. It was a camp there. The Americans had a bunch of, there was quite a few Italian prisoners there. I guess they were all dressed up in green. And so we hung around there for a day or two till the boat got in. And so we all got together again, and we were there for two or three days. And then we got on the, came over to Seattle, over to British Columbia, and then we came on, we stayed there for 3 days in Gordon Head Camp there in BC, and so the paymaster told us we're all going to get $200 a piece, he said, and he said, we'll be taking all your pay. He said, oh, you folks are going to be all fixed up when you get back home. He said, you don't have to worry about getting pension or anything like that. He said, you're all going to get fixed up. He said, we'll look after you. You're all going to be, we're all going to be 100% and all this stuff. We said, well, that's fine. He said, we'll see what happens when we get back. So anyway, we all got $200, and then we came over to Vancouver, and then I guess the fun started when we got to Vancouver, and from Vancouver to wherever our home was, and every day, well, the boys started saying, well, it's about time we had a drink. So we all had our own sleepers and everything, and there was four of us used to sit in one bed. I don't think we wanted to sleep all the time we left Vancouver, because we used to just run out when the train would stop at a station. Some of the boys would run over to the store and get a case of beer and that, and come back to the train and have a beer and talk and that. And so it was like that until we got home.
Where did you go?
We went, well, a lot of us, we stopped off here when the Grenadiers got stopped here, and we stopped here for a short period. And there was a woman here, Winnipeg, she wanted to hold over the train that Royal Rifle was on, that was going through down east. She wanted to hold over, and the CN or the CPs, they said they couldn't do it because they couldn't hold a train over on the siding that long. But we were all at the Union Station up here, and we were shaking hands with the Grenadiers that came back and with their mothers and their wives and their daughters and friends and everything. Was at the station was really packed. You couldn't move for anybody. So they had a hard time to round us up because everybody was all over the station talking to this, and we had a lot of Japanese money, and we gave it all away. Everybody was asking us for souvenirs now, so we gave them the Japanese money, whatever we had, and I just held on to one Japanese $10 bill, and I could have, somebody wanted that, but I said, I'll hold on to this for a souvenir. I said, maybe it's the only thing I'll keep. So we left there, and then we headed for down east, and the officers in charge, he had a pretty hard time keeping count of the boys, because every station we got, the train stopped, they lost 5 or 10 men on every station. So the time we got to Montreal, there were 75 men short. So they asked they also phone up the different station to have a station wagon ready to pick up the boys and pick them up, take them to the next station so they meet the train the next station. And the officer was getting so mad that he put the ban on us one day. He said we were losing too many men. So we had to keep quiet for a day. And then when we settled down the next day, he said, well, he said, since you boys were quiet and everything yesterday, he said, we'll take the guards off the door. He said, and go. But he said, please, he said, come back to the train. He said, I want to go back with somebody, you know. So we got back, and then the boys were getting off at different stations and where they lived, the nearest. And then I guess there was about 27 of us was the only ones left. And when we got down home in Halifax, and we arrived in Halifax about 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that, and there was a station wagon ready there. And an officer, a captain from the Army Service Corps, and he got us off the station wagon. He took us over to his number 6 depot, and everybody was asleep when we arrived there. But he said, I'll soon get them up. He said, I'll get the cook up and quartermaster store up and everything. He said, you guys gotta be had their breakfast and get your bed made up and everything. So he said, you folks just go in the hut. He said, no, I'll get everything ready. So he got the cook up, and the cook got up, and they went in the kitchen, and they done up some ham and eggs and toast and that. Then he got the quartermaster up, get the blankets over the mattress, and fixed up beds up that were empty there. And so I guess the next morning when we got up, the boys they were looking at us, wondering where we came from, because we had Hong Kong patches on our sleeve, and they didn't know if we were coming from somewhere or going.
What's a Hong Kong patch?
It's a round red patch, and it's supposed to be a gold HK, all in one, like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So I'll show it. It's the same as my button. I got a button. They asked us where we're coming or going. I said, we're coming and we're going home. And they asked what the patch was on our sleeve, and we said, a Hong Kong patch. It's a prison war. Oh. He said, yeah, but they wanted us to talk, sit down, talk, but we said, no, we can't sit down, talk. We got to go home. We've been away long enough. So the officer stopped us, and they wanted to talk, and we couldn't get out of the hut. So the sergeant major came along, and he said, I'm just going to make an excuse. He said, I want you to follow those sides. He said, in 5 minutes. So we said, well, we got to go outside. Sergeant Major wanted us. So we all got outside, and the Sergeant Major said, I know you fellas wanted to get home, and said, I just want to get you out here so you can get away from the yak, you know. So we got home, and I lived up on Lipton Street in Halifax, and they knew we were coming home, but they didn't know when. So when I went in the house and I knocked on the door, and my wife's her mother-in-law opened the door, and she said yes. I said, does Kathleen live here? Still live here? She said, yeah. She said, who are you? I said, I'm George. Well, he just stood there and looked at me as if I was a ghost or something. So they came in, they all started to cry and everything, and so I just stood there, and the wife came down, and she was stunned. She looked at me and she said, George, I said, yeah. You wouldn't recognize me, but I only weighed 90 pounds when I came home, and I weighed 175 pounds when I left, and they didn't recognize me. So And then after the wife, after we got settled down and everything, then I said, well, I must go down and see my mother and that. And I said, they still live in the same house now? And I said, yeah. So I went down there, and I went up to my sister's, and her husband was in the Navy, and so I knocked on the door, and she came to the door, and she had her hands all full of dough. She must have been making pies or something, and she said, yes. And I didn't say anything, I just looked at her, and she said, yes, what you want? I said, don't you recognize me? She said, no. I said, I'm George. Well, she could have fell over, but I was full of dough all over my hand and everything. I said, she just grabbed to hold me and pulled me in and hugged me, and my jacket was full of dough, but I didn't care for that. And then her husband came in, and he shook hands. He figured and took the hand off me. And then my father came up, and he went downtown. He met mother downtown in Eaton's, I believe. And she came up, and she just took one look at me and started to cry and everything. So I said, don't cry. I said, I'm home now. So she couldn't get over it. Nobody could get over it. And then when I went down home to see my other brothers and that, well, it was just one big happy family, I guess. So then I had to go to the depot every morning for roll call, but didn't have to stay to do any fatigue work like all over again. And the sergeant used to say, well, just roll call and you folks can go home. So one morning we went out for roll call, and after the roll call, the sergeant started picking out men for fatigues, and like working in the kitchen then. So one fellow said, how come you fellows don't go get called out for fatigue training? And I said, I don't know. I said, I guess we got something special to do. So I just let it go at that. And so the sergeant said, don't tell them that you got important business to attend to. So we just say, well, I got to go home now. So he said, well, how come you folks going home so early? Well, we said, we got to come back and we got to go home and do some business. Just let it go at that. I think when we're, time we were in Japan, I think it was in 44, when there was 25 of us. I worked the whole year with a hernia, and they used to have to take me home in a ration truck every night. For this went on for a year, and then when we went back to camp one night, and our sergeant, I forget his name, he lives over the West Coast. And he called our names out, and he said, we're going to Tokyo. He said, some were going up, I think it was 15 or 16, going to Japan for a convalescent. And there was 10 of us or more for operation. So I know I was going up for operation because I had trouble with my hernia. So we went to Tokyo, and the hospital they had was just was a coolie camp one time. You laid on the floor, there was no beds, and they didn't care how sick you were. So when the sergeant came over in the morning, and he said, now you're going over for your operation. Well, I said, ain't they going to give you anything to sensitive or anything? He said, there's nothing here to give you. He said, you do it while you're awake. I said, you couldn't do that. Oh, he said, they'd done an operation on a fellow here. He said they strapped him down on the bed and they used an ordinary knife on him. So he said, and that guy's walking around now. I said, it's awful torture, isn't it? He said, yeah. So anyway, they carried me over in a stretcher. And when I got over to the hospital, I was surprised on the equipment they had, because everything was there that would, for an operation room, like down home, like just like back home. Because it was all American equipment that the Japanese had. And they had more stuff, I guess, than we took it over. I said, gee whiz, this real setup for a hospital, and looked like real hospital equipment. And this commander, Cleveland, he was commander of the hospital down in Hong Kong there, and, but they said they took him over there in 1942 to do some operations and that for the Japanese, and he was teaching this Japanese doctor surgery work. So Commander Treven told me, he said, are you nervous? I said, yeah. He said, don't be nervous. He said, the Japanese doctor's not going to do it. He said, I am. Well, I said, I feel better now. So I said, how are they going to do it? Oh, he said, we'll give you a needle in the spine. He said, we'll freeze you from your hips down. So I sat alongside, got up on the operating table, and they had a real operating table, and he told me to sit up on the side. And so he stuck a small needle in my back first, and he put the other needle in, and then he said, turn around slowly and lie down on the bed on the operating table. He said, stretch your legs over. I said, and then in a few minutes, I got stiff from my hips down. I couldn't move. But I was all right until I looked up at the mirror. There was a mirror up over, and they were starting putting the weight pad on my side, and then just enough a hole in it so they were going to do the operation. And I didn't feel them open it, but when they opened it and the blood started to come out, and I took sick, and I had nothing to sew up with. I said I was just my stomach, and I said that was pretty sore, and I was just coughing that. And so the British orderly was there. He got a hold of me, and he got a cold wet rag, and he put it on my forehead. And he said, does that feel better? I said, yeah, but I said, I still feel sick. He said, yeah, I know. He said, you got nothing in your stomach. He said, that's what makes it rough. He said, yeah, you never had nothing to eat. He said, so it didn't take long for the operation. Then they put me on the stretcher, took me back to the hospital, back to the hut, and they put me on the floor, on the stretcher, ordinary stretcher, and they raised the foot up. They put bricks underneath the foot of the stretcher, like, and my legs were up, and my head was down, and I could almost, I could touch the floor with my nose, but I said it was pretty dirty. I said the hospital was damp, the water was running down the wall, and when I lied there, I said I was there for, I was laying on a stretcher for about 2 months, and I said, and then my wound it still was open after 2 months because the rashes we were getting wasn't healing up, you know. So then that's when the Americans started to bomb there, and everybody went outside and got in. They had foxholes outside, and the ones who were in bed, like laying on the floor, they had to stay there. And so one day when Americans came over, they were dogfight, I guess, the sound like it. I said, and then all of a sudden I heard something hit the wall like a bullet, like a straight bullet, hit the wall, and I was on one side of the wall, and I heard it come down and hit a can or a mess tin on the other side of the wall. And I said, when the air raid was over, and I heard the voice come back in, and the sound of the voice came where I was lying down on the stretcher, and so they came in, and the Japanese sergeant came in, and the officer, they found the bullet, and they asked the sergeant if it was one of theirs from the Japanese fighter plane. They said no, it was an American bullet because it was a 45 gauge, so it must have been from an American machine gun. And the officer said, who was laying on the bed? And I was just on the opposite side of the wall where this guy was. I said, he said, the bullet didn't come in. I said, no. I said, I just heard it come down. It came through the door and along the ceiling and down to this where the fellow's bed was. And I said, I heard everything, because I said, there was only about three of us in the hospital that couldn't get up. I said, because just then a couple of days after that, I needed a bowel movement, and I coughed and broke two stitches. So man of treatment, he came over and he had to put two more stitches in it, and it took me that much longer to get healed up. So then we went back. They took us back to, we left Tokyo, went back to camp, and so they told me I could stay. I had to work around the camp for about a month or two before I could get healed up. But they didn't wait that long. They sent me back to the courtyard, and I still had the bandage on, but they didn't care as long as they had you over to work, and they put you on. I didn't push no cars, or I wasn't carrying any coal. They just got me to take the water around to the boys, you know. But it took a long time before they healed up, but it healed up real good. But then at that time, I got two plagiar sores I got on my feet that I got from the courtyard, and the Japanese used to, every morning, used to take the scab off of them, and he used to open it up and just put a bandage on it and tell me I could go to work. But I had no shoes for about 2 months, and then when they got an order, they put an order in for the boys that had no shoes, because all the boys, the sizes were too big, and the Japanese shoes were too small, so they had to wait for probably 2 or 3 months before they got the order back from the factory, because some of the boys, well, they take from 7s to 14, 16, size 16, you know. So they were good runners, and they were waterproof, but that's the only thing we wore until I got home. And after I got home, it was my feet had a hard time getting shoes to fit, because my feet were swollen up from beriberi and that I got in Hong Kong. And so I still have problems with my feet. And so when I got home, and then after I was home for a while, for over a year, and then I went to work up in Campbell Hospital, DBA. I worked there for a while. And then my brother-in-law, when the war was over, he went back to the Merchant Navy, and he had been going to sea for quite a while. And so one day he asked me if I wanted to go for a trip. And I said, well, I said, I can't. I said, I'm only got a day and a half off. I said, I got to go back to work. I said, when my day and a half is finished. So he said, come on. And so I went with him, and I was gone for about 6 months. I went as an ordinary seaman, so back. So I was in the Merchant Navy for a while, and then after that I came home, and my mother, she didn't know I was gone, or the wife didn't know I was gone. So when I came home, and then I said, I guess I won't be going to see anymore, because my brother-in-law was mad at me because I got hurt on the ship. And he told me when I got home to go to the union and pay my dues, and tell him that I was waiting for the ship to come back to Halifax so I can rejoin it. And because he said he wanted me to take another trip with him, and he said he was sure that I'd get back on the ship, because I got hurt, and the captain said there was no reason why that I couldn't meet the ship after I came back from Halifax, and we were supposed to go to Italy. cargo of coal. But I didn't go up and pay my dues, so I just stayed home and then I got work in government building, new building in Halifax called the Ralston Building. I was running a passenger elevator. There had four elevators there, and I took a place of a fellow that had to go and get a heart operation, and I was next on the list for a permit on the elevator operator, but I was on just part time. But some of the boys, I got a letter from one of the boys from Winnipeg and asked me when I was going to come out to Winnipeg to see them, and I said maybe one of these days I'll make up my mind and come out. But so I was still working in the Ralston Building, and I was working at the Legion at night time, so I was kept pretty busy. So so one day I told the head fellow of the elevator, I said, I'm going over to Winnipeg. He said, what do you want to leave this job for, a good job like that? He said, you're going to be, you're next on the list for a permit. I said, no, I said, maybe I'd go to Winnipeg and for a change. So he said, he kept arguing with me. He said, you don't want to go there. He said, you're going to lose a good job and that. Well, I said, I still got my mind up to go to Winnipeg, but he tried to convince me that not to go. But one day I came in and I told him I was going to leave at the end of the month, and he told me I was crazy. I said, maybe I am, but I said, I'm still going. I said, he said, it's pretty cold out there. He said, lots of snow in it. I said, you get lots of snow here too. I said, it can't be any colder in here. I said, might be, climate might be better. So he couldn't convince me, so he didn't know I'd leave, but I did. The end of the month came, and I told him I was leaving the next day, and came out by train. That was in 59, and I was here for a couple months, and then I went to work in the Medical and Arts Building there for a while. And then the work was kind of rough for me, and I had to quit that. And then I joined one of the branches, the Royal Canadian Legion, at I think it was Norwood branch. And then later on I got transferred to the Duke of Kent branch, which I am now. And then I met this girl, this Lorraine, and we went out dancing that, and then we decided to get married. So we got married. We're married now for about 8 years. 8 years, huh? And I got a daughter. She's 7. And I had been working as a commissioner in a Corps of Commissioners, but now that the doctor said I had to quit kind of my health, and I tried to get day work, but they said they got no day work. It's mostly night shift, and the doctor said it was no good for me. And so now I got to stay. I'm on sick leave at home, and so I'm just trying to make the best of it now, until I see what the government is going to. I'm waiting, keep my fingers crossed for see if I'm going to get my 100% or not.
What's wrong with your eyes?
It's my kidneys bothered me, and that infection sets in every once in a while.
My legs,
I had 3 or 4 operations since I came over.
Your bladder?
Yeah, my bladder. My eyes bothered me quite a bit, and I had a big operation on my legs. I had varicose veins. I had 2 operations on my legs, and they said if they took any more, there's only a few veins left in the legs, and if they take any more out, my legs wouldn't be any good anymore. So the doctor told me I had to quit work and see if it would help. And I don't feel any better now than I did when I quit. But
you wish you were back.
I did feel I was always complaining about my sore back now because they figured it was the work, but I still got the same problem. And I still got to wait and see the doctor when I go see the doctor on the 1st of March. And then he'll find out if the work is not the problem. And then there might be something else, so then they're going to look into it. But I'm just hoping that this 100% pension that I'm supposed to get come true.
One thing I want to ask you, because I'm like, how old are you?
57.
I'm going to stop.